Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Live today from the Green Space, our ground floor theater here at WNYC, as we do about once a month with an audience here of about 100 people. Thank you all for coming. Before we get to our first guests, let's see who's here. Let's tell everybody in Radio Land and everybody on the stage who's here. Applaud if you're from Manhattan. Makes sense. Theater's in Manhattan. Easy place to get to. Applaud if you're from Brooklyn. Any other borough? New Jersey is not a borough. And did you think I was going to leave you out? Applaud if you're from New Jersey. And from anywhere else, including Nassau, Westchester, Russia, or anywhere else in the world. How many of you were from Russia? Never mind. How many of you criminally bought your way into college? How many of you legally bought your way into college? How many of you, serious question, consider yourselves democratic socialists? A few. The people on the stage wanted to know if they're allowed to applaud. I'm sure. But they didn't. They're in front of microphones. At this time of day, I imagine we have many retired people in the audience. So how many of you here right now are on Medicare? Of you, how many prefer your Medicare to the private insurance you had before you started on Medicare? And prefer, there's no right answer. How many of you are less happy with Medicare than your past private insurance? Okay, interesting. So mostly Medicare, not all, small sample. How many of you consider democratic socialism to mean we should not have a capitalistic society? Just your interpretation of what democratic socialism means. Does it mean we should not have a capitalistic society? Did that question stump you? How many of you think democratic socialism does not mean we should not have a capitalistic society? All right, I see smiles on the podium, which means people think you sort of like get it. So it may surprise many other people to hear what New York City's most famous new democratic socialist said about this over the weekend. Here is Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez at South by Southwest.
When we talk about ideas, for example, like democratic socialism, it means putting democracy and society first instead of capital first. It doesn't mean that you put other things last. It doesn't mean that the actual concept of capital as a society should be abolished or anything like that. But it's a question of our priorities.
So, interesting. Last one, I promise. How many of you think of democratic socialism as mostly being a politics of aiming left as opposed to aiming right? Yeah. Well, at South by Southwest, AOC framed it more as the politics of aiming high rather than aiming low. Listen.
It feels like moderate is not a stance. It's just an attitude toward life of like,
well, don't hold back. Tell me how you really feel about incrementalism.
But here's the thing that upsets me is that we've become so cynical that we view meh or we view cynicism as an intellectually superior attitude, and we view ambition as youthful naivete. When we think about the greatest things we have ever accomplished as a society have been ambitious acts of vision. And the meh is like worship now for what?
AOC with Breonna Gray from The Intercept at South by Southwest. The greatest thing we've ever accomplished as a society, things have been ambitious acts of visions. So what are we capable of today?
We are capable of saving the planet, of guaranteeing healthcare as a right, of educating our children through college. We are capable of establishing all work as dignified, of respecting people's cultures, of having an economy that not only welcomes immigrants, but needs immigrants because we are being so productive. We are capable of all of these things.
So, AOC in Austin. With me now here in the green space, three leaders of the new democratic socialism movement here in New York, Sean McElwee, contributor to The Nation and co-founder of the group Data for Progress, which calls itself the think tank of the future of progressivism. Sarah Leonard, executive editor of the criminal justice-oriented news site The Appeal. When I moderated a Bernie versus Hillary supporters debate in 2016, she was one of the Bernie supporters. Remember that?
I do.
And Waleed Shaheed, communications director for the Justice Democrats, a group working within the Democratic Party. Their description on their Twitter feed says, "We helped elect AOC because it's time for a Democratic Party that represents its voters, not just corporate donors. The political revolution is here." So now you know what they're all about, more or less. Thank you all for being here. And please welcome our guests. And just to get some terms straight first, do you all identify as democratic socialists?
Yes.
Yes, Sarah?
Yeah.
Sean, yes?
I brought my DSA card with me.
DSA card.
We'll never be without it.
The thing the Congresswoman said in the first clip, democratic socialism means putting democracy and society first, not that the actual concept of capitalistic society should be abolished. Who could flesh that out for our audience? Sean, maybe you want to start, and our listeners a little bit. If a real progressive has a chance in 2020 and the movement wants broad acceptance in general, maybe it's important for what that means to be really clear.
All right. I have to speak slowly so I don't end up accidentally swearing. I would say that the sort of goals of the movement, you have like the sort of longer term goals, and then you have the more immediate goals that could be accomplished within 5 to 10 to 15 years. So something like Medicare for All is an idea that we could accomplish within our lifetimes. We have a program that is called Medicare. It covers a large and growing share of the American population. It's not impossible to imagine expanding that system to cover everyone. And that is a clear political goal. We have a climate crisis that requires an immense mobilization that is going to require large investments of government spending, and also I think in many cases direct government intervention in the economy, direct government control of where which resources go where. We have, you know, massive companies like ExxonMobil that on their balance sheets and priced into their stock market price of their company are assets in the form of fossil fuels that we know cannot ever be burnt. All of these are problems that simply cannot be solved by markets. What the goal of, I think, democratic socialists is to increase the share of resources, decision-making in the economy that is controlled by democratic means rather than simply by individual people who tend to be disproportionately men, disproportionately white, disproportionately, incredibly wealthy, obviously. And those are the things that are in our minds. You know, me and Waleed spend a lot of time, like, how do we elect more progressive Democrats? And those Democrats, when they talk to voters, are talking about these sorts of questions, these sorts of very concrete policies that people can understand. And that is sort of the way that I approach these issues.
So let me bring Waleed into it next. And thank you, by the way, for your restraint in helping us maintain our FCC license. Waleed, how about the not for the actual concept of capitalistic society being abolished part?
Yeah, I think a lot of those kinds of terms are red herrings. I don't think anyone is calling for the complete abolition of, you know, not having a Hershey's bar at your bodega, for example, or anything like that to eliminate consumer goods. But I think what democratic socialism is more of a critique of the current capitalist system and a smarter way of thinking about how the economy can grow and provide for all workers, not just for people at the top. So right now, we have the three richest men in this country own more wealth than the bottom 50% of Americans combined. 60% of Americans can't afford a $500 emergency medical bill. The wealth and income keeps getting stacked at the top 1%. Life expectancy last year declined in America, a trend not seen since World War I when we had a flu pandemic. So if capitalism is going fine, these things wouldn't be happening. There's something wrong with the system, the way the economy is being run, the way the markets are being run. And the best example of this is the fossil fuel industry. This is what happens when you just allow markets to run free, to not be restrained by government intervention, by alternative ways of thinking about how the government could provide not only for the planet but for workers. So, you know, and then one last thing I'd like to add is that a lot of these ideas, democratic socialism, social democracy, liberalism, these terms are kind of been interchangeable a lot in U.S. history, in European history. And there are large books about the debates between these theories. But at the end of the day, these concepts, you know, as you said earlier, are not necessarily new. FDR talked about the right to health care for all Americans. Harry Truman introduced a government-run insurance program in the 1940s. Democrats have been talking about single-payer health care for basically most of the century. So when AOC is talking about why not now, it's not like these concepts are new. People have been talking about this for a long time. So I appreciate the urgency she's bringing to the debate.
Right. And Sarah, Bernie Sanders does identify as a democratic socialist. Elizabeth Warren says she does not. When Warren announced her break up the big tech companies antitrust proposal last week, she framed it as a strike for true competitive capitalism, not an act of socialism. Are you enthusiastic about that?
I think it's a great starting point. I will take it. During the New Deal, socialists famously joked that they're trying to save capitalism from itself and capital wouldn't let them. And that appears to be what's happening right now. As Voshan and Walid said, the system is obviously not working. And in fact, the ways in which it has increased radical inequality has created enemies of the system as it stands, and has proved a rallying point for the left, for people who want to regulate these companies, for redistribution, for what we're calling democratic socialism. And I think, you know, something that does distinguish democratic socialism from all these other terms is that it does give you a kind of ambitious North Star in a way that, excuse me, just being a Democrat does not. So when we talk about democratic socialism, in the long run, we hope for not just greater equality, but an expansion of democracy out of this narrow realm that we currently consider political, which is the voting booth or electoral campaigns, which are very important. But can we have more democracy in day-to-day life? Can we have more democracy in our workplace? Can we democratize the economy, which is where we spend much of our time in our lives? And so I think having that sort of ambitious vision of greater freedom in society is something that does distinguish democratic socialism as an idea.
It's interesting that you put it in terms of ambition, as the Congresswoman did at South by Southwest, right? We played the clip in which she identified democratic socialism as aiming high rather than meh. We're capable of establishing all work as dignified. Remember, the clip said, capable of saving the planet, respecting people's cultures, and that needs immigrants because we're so productive. And that's really interesting to me. And what you just said is really interesting to me, because some people consider socialism a flattening of ambition, like guaranteeing minimums for all, not much upside reward for being really successful. Do you think that's a stereotype that centrally needs to be busted?
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, a flattening is not how I think of socialism at all. Flattening is what's happening now, where people spend all their time at work. And as Walid pointed out, the vast majority of people are falling down to the same level of just getting by, and just a few people are rising to the top. That's like a pretty flat society with a few people at the top having a really great time. And I want to, you know, speak to what she said about moderates, because there's a reason that our most famous moderates in this country are billionaires. You know, our very own Michael Bloomberg is a very famous moderate, and he's a billionaire. Howard Schultz is a billionaire moderate. And the reason they can be moderate is the system is working super, super well for them. So when they get into this race, you know, they're talking about, they're afraid of their taxes being raised. You know, I mean, Howard Schultz said that right out. And you've never heard of a moderate working class hero, because people who are actually suffering, for them, radical change is not some sort of abstract idea. It's an obvious necessity. And so I think when we talk about moderates, we're often talking about people who are not just holding some sort of intellectual position, but have a big material stake in things staying exactly the same.
Now, listeners, we can take phone calls for our three guests as we talk about democratic socialism in America in 2019. Sean McElwee, co-founder of Data for Progress, Sarah Leonard, the executive editor of the news site The Appeal, and Waleed Shaheed, communications director for Justice Democrats, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. An audience here in the green space, raise your hands and we'll come around with a microphone. For either of you, Waleed, maybe you, on moderation, just being meh, and Sarah was just talking about the billionaires like Howard Schultz. NBC News is reporting this morning that Schultz, who of course was the Starbucks founder running for president as an independent, will promise not to nominate a Supreme Court justice unless he or she can be confirmed by 2/3 of the Senate, not just the 51 votes required now, and or not even the 60. That's the, you know, normal filibuster buster. And he will vow not to sign any legislation that does not have bipartisan support. Additionally, he said he'd assemble a diverse cabinet of Democrats, Republicans, and independents, and create an independent commission to replace gerrymandering. Now, he would argue, I'm sure, that that's hardly meh. What that is pulling us back from the polarization that's tearing the country apart. Any reaction to any of those ideas, Waleed?
Yeah, I mean, not only does Howard Schultz have a fringe economic ideology, he also has a fringe political strategy for how things should be accomplished to solve crises that working families are going through. I mean, everything that you just said is much less likely to happen than Medicare for All. So I would like to start there. I mean, the other thing about just Howard Schultz is that I think that Sarah's right, that there is this tradition of politics that used to be seen in people like Bill Clinton and Joe Biden is increasingly not in the mainstream of the Democratic Party, that the center of energy is with people like Elizabeth Warren and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders. And just, you know, in the 6 months that Alexandria has been elected, she's shown how much a Democrat who's willing to fight for big ideas, to really go to war with not only Republicans, but members of the billionaire class, that you can widen the political realm of possibility so much by just fighting for these things. I mean, when was the last time you saw a Democrat go on CNN, go on public radio, go on MSNBC to talk about raising taxes, marginal tax rates on multimillionaires to 70%?
I can't
think of anyone.
Not to 70%, but raising marginal tax rates on millionaires, yes.
I see the problem in American society is that the sort of inputs of democracy in the outputs don't really align anymore. Someone noted yesterday that AOC, the entire time that she's been alive, the Republican Party has won the popular vote a single time. They now control the presidency. They control the Senate. Until recently, they controlled the House. They control a basically permanent majority on the Supreme Court. And just yesterday, they flipped the Third Circuit Court under Obama's tenure from Republican to Democrat. I do a lot of polling at Data Progress. If I had gone into the 115th Congress and asked people, like, what are your top priorities? What do you want to see this Congress do? I am very confident that massively cutting taxes from the wealthy and stripping health care from children was not what the general public wanted. But that's what they got. And, you know, the Affordable Care Act had as part of its law, Medicaid expansion. That expansion was struck down from the bench by John Roberts. Since then, that Medicaid expansion has been put on the ballot across the country a dozen times. Every time it's passed, except for one time in Montana when they tied it to an increase in the cigarette tax. In states like Tennessee, Medicaid expansion polls incredibly well. In every instance, it has been stymied by an increasingly radical Republican Party. And I think that what Howard Schultz and what many elites in this country will acknowledge is that fundamentally the Republican Party is the problem with American politics. You know, this is a party. Yes, thank you. And you know, and like that is why I think young people have this like fire that everyone's like, why are you so mad? It's like, we've won the five that every time. We don't get anything. They're cutting taxes for rich people and taking away healthcare from kids instead of, you know, solving the environmental crisis that we're facing. And we're watching these problems pile up and pile up and pile up and pile up. And then we face this problem where you look at like, all right, well, like, you know, at least in 2020, we'll have a Democrat. And it's like, oh, wait, but then are we going to take the Senate? And then if we take the Senate, is Joe Manchin going to like screw us over? Okay. And then we'll finally get like one of the things that we want to do done. Like maybe we'll get the Green New Deal or maybe we'll get Medicare for All. And the Republicans will like win again in that House. And we'll have to like wait 10 more years to do another one thing. And it's like really, really frustrating to then hear like, well, okay, now, you know, what we need to do is we need to come together. We need to bring Republicans and Democrats together. And it's just like, what is going to come of that? You know, we have tried that sort of strategy. We have tried, and, you know, the entire Obama first term, we tried to, like, give something to Republicans to bring them to the table. And at every
cap
time.
Cap and trade said, rather yeah, exactly. than a carbon tax and sure. got zero votes. Obamacare rather than Medicare for All and got zero Republican votes.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to say, like, I'm mad. I don't really have a point beyond that.
That's a big point. You made a big point. See, you got audience applause. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to continue with this panel. We'll start taking your calls and audience questions here in the green space. And kind of as a follow-up to what Sean McElwee from Data for Progress was just saying, Waleed, I'm going to ask when we come back about your article in The Nation in October, which suggested that a progressive caucus within the House of Representatives might be more important than who the presidential nominee is. So stay with us. WNYC with you live from the green space today. And by the way, when we are live in the green space, you can watch the Brian Lehrer Show as well as listen because we stream live on our website at WNYC.org and on the WNYC Facebook page. So check us out and see all these people who are on stage and me. And I don't know if we have cutaways of the audience. I'm not sure if the cameras work that way. But you can see the green space at WNYC.org or the WNYC Facebook page with our guests, Sean McElwee, co-founder of the group Data for Progress, which calls itself a think tank for the future of progressivism, Sarah Leonard, executive editor of the criminal justice-oriented news site The Appeal, and Waleed Shaheed, communications director for Justice Democrats, a group working within the Democratic Party, described on their Twitter feed as, "We helped elect AOC because it's time for a Democratic Party that represents its voters, not just corporate donors." And let's go right to a phone call. Here is Joyce in Oceanside. Joyce, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Can hear you fine.
Okay, good. So you're talking about radical change. AOC... supplanted Joseph Crowley. I'd like to talk as a victim of the machine that Joseph Crowley set up in the Queen's judiciary. Okay? I know Ross Barkin
You told our screener you wanted to talk about the college cheating scandal. Are you going to talk about that?
Yes, as well.
Then make your Crowley point really concisely, okay?
Okay. As a symptom, the college cheating scandal is a symptom of a much broader problem that you've been addressing a bit, which is that money buys everything. Okay? I am a victim of another system in which money buys everything. The family courts in Queens and elsewhere, but I can speak to Queens, where judges are appointed by the Democratic machine. There is no independent oversight. There is zero accountability, and my ex-husband spent over $1 million in legal fees to plead poverty in court. My children and I were railroaded by the system. Okay, and I'd like to ask when the sunlight that has been shining in the recent day or so, and apparently in the investigation longer than that, on the scandal that was announced yesterday, I'd like to know when accountability will be, when we will see some accountability, some transparency in the court, in the family court system, in the foreclosure court system, the systems that are run by the Democratic machine in Queens.
Joyce, thank you very much for your call. We really appreciate it. Who wants to address any part of that? Sarah?
Yeah. So I obviously can't speak directly to this case or courtroom, but the problems that she's speaking to are very, very real. For one, there's no transparency in the judiciary at all. It's barely covered by the press as well. Something the appeal has been looking into expanding our coverage of is actually the judiciary. Because you've probably all had this experience. You go and vote, and you have to check off a bunch of judges. You cannot find information on who they are, why you would vote for one or the other, why they're there. I mean, it's so undemocratic and dysfunctional. And fines and fees in the court system are also a massive problem. There are municipalities across the United States. I mean, this was famously the case in Ferguson, where police departments are actually funded by collecting fines and fees from people, which, of course, incentivizes the police to come up with ways to collect those fines and fees, whether that's pulling people over, whether that's charging people in court, whether or not they've been found guilty of anything. And what this does is increase poverty, obviously, create fear and unfairness in the justice system. And it's just incredibly destructive to communities. And then I would say further that the coalitions that we've seen get built around the country to replace prosecutors who were incredibly punitive, we've seen this from Chicago to Texas. I mean, this is a national trend. These are exactly the coalitions we would want to see in building a new progressive left. These are coalitions of labor unions, people of color, poor people's advocates, all sorts of left-wing organizations, because these unfair and punitive justice systems tear communities apart on every level, whether it's increasing poverty through fines and fees or putting people in prison for long lengths of time. Those coalitions that have come together around prosecutor elections are, I think, going to start coming together more and more around judicial elections. And in fact, there was a DSA judge elected in Texas who has been talking a lot about the choices that judges make and how we can make better, more progressive choices in the courtroom, how this supposedly neutral position is actually highly political, and we can do it a lot better. So those are all essential points that she's talking about.
Thank you very much. Let's go to a question here in the green space. Hello there.
Hi, my name is Lisa. I'm from Manhattan. I want to return to the 50,000-foot level about democratic socialism and say, you know, I think that there has been obviously some pushback against the concept. I heard Rahm Emanuel talking about how it's a gift to the Republicans to put all this, you know, really left-wing stuff out there, and it's difficult. As a Cold War baby myself, I mean, I remember the Bay of Pigs. I wonder if we're all a little bit under a hangover of the Cold War, and that when we hear the word socialism, we freak out. So why is it that you guys have not given some vision of the real-life examples, a vision of what countries have succeeded with this model, and can you give some of those examples so that people can gravitate towards something instead of simply away from something and get away from the fear in our society?
Thank you. So what's a country that would be the closest model to what you might be aiming for? Anyone? Sarah, go ahead.
I want to take up all the space. So we often point to the Nordic countries as sort of an interim model, right? And I know that in some ways that's unsatisfying to people because obviously the Nordic countries are not some sort of post-capitalist utopia and are themselves capitalist societies, but with serious social safety nets and large restrictions on capital. So, you know, this is currently closer to what we're aiming for. That's the, you know, I can't give you a perfect model of the perfect society. I don't think liberals could either. You know, I think in many ways, socialists are the only people asked to describe a perfect utopia with no bumps in the road along the way because we're proposing something new. And, you know, fair enough. So I think one way to think about it is something those countries are doing correctly that we want to do more is take things off the market that don't belong there. I might say decommodify things, but another way to say it would simply be that something like healthcare, something like saving us all from dying in a global warming apocalypse, those should not be left up to the vagaries of the market. And so we actually have a lot of models for how that can be done. And that's what we're looking at right now. Those are all the practical policies we're talking about.
And I think we're going to continue sort of at the 50,000 feet level with our next caller, Peter in the Bronx on line 7. Peter, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Yes. The word socialism used to have a particular meaning is an economic system which had to do with collective ownership of the means of production and distribution. It has become such an elastic, plastic concept. For the Republicans, it's Medicare is socialism. For Bernie, although the last comment may change this, the Scandinavian countries were socialists, even though they call themselves social democratic, and even though they have lower corporate taxes and better... A Forbes said it's a better place to do business than the United States. I have no idea what is... I don't know why you guys don't call yourself social democrats, because that seems to be what you are, although the last comment seems to point to some utopian notions, which I worry very much about, because it's basically a concentration of power in the government.
Peter, I'm going to leave it there and get a response. Waleed and Sean... you know who else made the same comment to me off the air? I don't think he said it off the record, so I think I can say this. We had Peter, we had Rutger Bregman on the show yesterday, the guy who famously, you know, spoke back to the people at Davos and spoke back to Tucker Carlson in that Fox News interview and wrote the book. I'm trying to remember the name of the book. Utopia for Realists. So just giving Rutger Bregman his due, Dutch, and I guess he'd call himself social democrat, because he said to me off the air, why do the American progressives insist on calling themselves democratic socialists when it's such difficult branding here? Why don't they just call themselves social democrats? Waleed, since you came with your DSA card.
Well, I think that's what people are calling it. And so even in Europe, the countries that are social democracies, the parties that enact those policies are often called the Socialist Party of Sweden, the Socialist Party of France, the Socialist Party of Spain. Like these are the names of the parties even in those countries. So that's when I started off, I was saying sometimes these terms are a little, not just loose in the US, but loose in Europe. The other thing I'd like to say is that even at South by Southwest, there was a German woman who asked AOC this question on why don't the Democrats just defend democratic socialism and social democracy as what Scandinavia already has? Why does Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris and Cory Booker stand up and applaud at the State of the Union when Trump says America will never be a socialist country? Why do they give in to that? And AOC's response was, because Democrats don't believe in social democracy. That it's there are lots of Democrats who don't support these kinds of things like Medicare for All or free college. Increasingly, you know, the center of energy is moving and Democrats are coming around to it. But again, I think that there's this play happening where some of these terms are loose. And at the end of the day, like a lot of the programs that the United States did in the 1930s, 1940s, the GI Bill, you could call those social democratic socialist programs. And those are the very same programs that are under attack today. You know, at the end of the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King would say often that basically this country did have a social democracy for white male workers for a lot of this country. And what this country has never had is a multiracial social democracy where everyone has a right to free college.
And that kind of brings me to the articles that Waleed, you and Sean, you wrote in the last few months with, I think, overlapping themes. Sean, yours in These Times, suggest that progressives in 2020 focus on primarying centrist Democrats in blue districts more than trying to flip purple districts. Can you explain?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I missed my chance to talk about Rahm Emanuel, and I was sad.
Go ahead.
I shouldn't, for the sake of your FCC license. Suffice to say, if anyone knows how to help Republicans, it's certainly Rahm Emanuel. But what I think that like what we're really interested in doing is, you know, what has changed the most the Democratic Party in the last few months has been, I think, the most exciting is, you know, leaders of the next generation of the Democratic Party, almost all women of color leaders, leaders like Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, Ocasio-Cortez, Deb Haaland, Johanna Hayes, have fundamentally changed the Democratic Party. And all of these women were elected in safe Democratic districts, replacing, you know, in some cases quite liberal, in other cases more moderate Democrats. And that has fundamentally changed the way that we talk about politics in America. A lot of these conversations about race and gender that have sort of been discussed in happy hours and in academic articles and in forums are now being front and center in the Democratic Party. And we still have a lot of sort of Democrats who are sort of go along to get along in D plus 15 to 30 districts. They have zero chance of ever losing a general election to a Republican. And yet, why are they not leading on important issues that matter to the base? And I think that there's an increasing age divide, and it sort of comes from this fact that, like, guys like Joe Biden sort of remember this other Republican Party. They sort of are still afraid of ideas like abolishing ICE. They're still afraid of ideas like Green New Deal. And what we're saying is that in these safe Democratic districts, we can have real progressive leaders, and we can have people who approach issues differently. I think that Presley and Capuano is the perfect example. Like, no one doubts that Capuano was a very good vote, a very liberal person.
Liberal Democrat from Massachusetts, yeah, who got primaried and defeated by Ayanna Pressley.
I assume everyone just knows, you know. You're not getting your Cook political report, and you know. And then, and what we have now instead is Ayanna Pressley, and Ayanna Pressley just talks about progressive issues in a different way. When she talks about gun violence, she talks about it from the experience of both a community that's had a lot of gun violence and also someone whose father has spent time in prison, and she talks about that. When she talks about sexual assault, she does it as a survivor. And that means a lot, and that matters, and the Democratic Party should represent that.
We have and Waleed, your article in The Nation in October suggested a progressive caucus within the House of Representatives, like Sean was just talking about, it might be more important than who the presidential nominee is. Can you explain?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I hope there's a Democrat in the White House in 2021, but at the same time, that Democrat is only going to be as progressive as the Democrats in the House and Senate push them to be. So, you know, I worked on the Cynthia Nixon campaign. After the campaign ended, I basically read a bunch of Eric Foner books about the radical Republicans, because that is what I do on vacation. And all basically a lot of his work is about how this radical Republican caucus, radical meaning abolitionist at that time, not what it is currently, really pushed Lincoln tooth and nail to really come around to the crazy idea that maybe we should abolish slavery now, not in 10 years, not in 20 years. And so Thaddeus Stevens is the most well-known abolitionist Republican, famously depicted in the Lincoln movie. And he's introducing bills constantly to abolish slavery as soon as possible. And they never pass. It's kind of like how Bernie Sanders has spent his entire career in Congress. Ultimately, the Republican Party catches up to him because that radical caucus grows over time. And I just, if you had a larger, stronger progressive caucus like you do now in 2009, maybe we would have seen a public option happen. Maybe that caucus would have pushed President Obama to not negotiate from the beginning with Republicans, rather make the case and fight for a public option. And so the progressive caucus right now, led by Pramila Jayapal and Mark Pocan, is the strongest it's ever been in generations. And I really think that, you know, electing, you know, Democratic socialists, progressives, putting a lot of us, you know, I also want to backtrack, like, a lot of us were involved with Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, the People's Climate March, the Dreamer Movement. The leaders of those movements, a lot of them are Democratic Socialists. And for, you know, all the marches, rallies, and sit-ins we did, the media would always tell us, you need to make political change from the inside. So now we're here, and they're telling us to get out, and the Democratic Party establishment is telling us to not be involved in party politics, not be involved in electoral politics. So this has been coming for a long time, and now, as Sean was saying, we have political expression for these ideas.
Let's take another question from here in the green space. Hi there.
Hi. So in an effort to come down from the 50,000-foot level and get at some of the financials and the economics of the vision that I hear you describing, you have a progressive caucus in the House and the Senate and an interested Democratic president. So you've achieved all that you want structurally in the political institutions. What could you articulate some vision of what wealth redistribution, taxation policy would look like for us in the future? Because I think that's where we get bogged down today in trying to articulate why the masses should embrace this type of approach as opposed to feeling immediately threatened by 40%, 50% income taxes like they have in the Scandinavian. So is there an elevator talk that you could, you know, give us 90 seconds that we could bring to a cocktail party, assuming your political vision has been, you know, not elected in 2020?
Everybody's thinking. Sean, go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the nice things about the concentration of the wealth, you know, in the hands of just 100 people, it means you only got to take it from 100 people. It's very easy now. The Koch brothers, they're just like doing our job for us. They're getting all in one place, and we can just... No, I mean...
But then a lot of upper middle class people will say, and even lower, you know, middle class people will say, oh, first they're going to come for the 100, and then they're going to come for me.
I mean, a starting point always is to say that we're spending massively right now. The government is spending like Marie Antoinette on billionaires, you know, I mean, like tax cuts, you know, money to the military industrial complex, et cetera. I mean, it's a very free spending government at the moment, actually. The question is redirecting it in a productive way. We're currently spending it on things we don't want and we don't need, things that are actually increasing inequality. And when Trump went for his massive tax cut, nobody talked about that as spending. And of course, that's spending. So I think to Sean's point, actually, like the starting point is understanding that we're doing a lot of spending in the wrong places. But I cut you off.
Oh, no, it's okay. No, I was going to say that the sort of like I look at study public opinion, and public opinion tends to be very thermostatic. So you have like sort of public opinion when there's like not a lot of government spending, people want more of it. And then when there's more government spending, people want less of it. And what we're sort of seeing in public opinion today is that more and more people, like, so when I do polling, like my cutoff for like the highest income normally is 100,000. If you sample like 1,200 people, you know, that's the number of people who you can sort of make the top income bracket. But when the economists talk about inequality, they don't talk about 100,000 as the top 1%. They're talking about people who are in the millions, right? And so what I see is that there are a lot of people out there who make 100,000 a year who are far less worried about taxes than they are about affording childcare, affording a single medical bill could still bankrupt them. You know, college debt could bankrupt them. And so you actually have more and more people who view themselves not as the sort of people who are going to be victimized by taxation, but instead people who would be the beneficiaries of better social services, better government spending.
We're just about out of time. I want to just give each of the three of you a chance in like 20 seconds. If that was an elevator pitch, think of this as a cubicle pitch. just on your way out, just to shout out your organizations and what they do, because they're not all that well known. Sean, I'm going to stay with you. Data for Progress, what is it? Come on.
I call us a Posadist hive mind. No, I mean, we do a lot of research, polling. We do blueprints for policy. But we also try to actually make those real by engaging in politics.
Sarah, people should know about your relatively new news organization, The Appeal. What is it?
Yes, everyone should be reading The Appeal. And 87% of incarceration happens at the state and county level. The most powerful people in the system are prosecutors and people with power on that local level. Nobody reports on it. Local news has been decimated. Everyone wants to talk about the death penalty or private prisons, which are horrible, real parts of the system, but very small parts of the system. And so what we've done is we are building an organization to report on where incarceration is actually happening and report on prosecutors who never get covered and actually, you know, giving daily coverage to this massive undercovered part of the justice system. So as you can tell, it's like a really bright read to start your morning with. But we also have two amazing podcasts, and so you can listen on the way to work.
Waleed?
JusticeDemocrats.com, you can find out more. We are the organization that helped recruit Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We helped elect Rashida Tlaib. We're fighting on big issues like the Green New Deal, rejecting corporate PAC money, Medicare for All, and basically trying to primary the old guard of the Democratic Party that does not agree with anything we've said.
Green Space audience, please thank Waleed Shahid, Sarah Leonard, and Sean McAlee. And when we continue in a minute, we'll have the brand newly elected New York City public advocate here in the Green Space, Jumaane Williams. Stay with us.